Lawyers for the cousins objected, claiming such a forfeiture, while their clients were still technically considered innocent, was premature. It was the same argument defense attorneys had been screaming about for 20 years. Unfair as it seemed, the law was the law, and the auction netted $3.3 million. The first drop in what would become a very large bucket. A week later, the receiver sold a shopping center for $2.1 million and the assumption of debt. The dismantling of the DuBose syndicate was underway. Watching closely was a lawyer who represented Verna Hatch. After the auction, he filed a $10 million wrongful death lawsuit under the civil RICO statute and notified the receiver that he intended to place a lien against the estate. The receiver really didn't care. It wasn't his money. Following Verna's lead, Lacey filed a lawsuit for her own injuries. Tracking the assets of Claudia McDover and Phyllis Turbin was not quite as complicated as chasing the dirty money used by the syndicate. Once the FBI had all of Turbin's records, the trail became clear. Fronted by offshore companies, the ladies had purchased a villa in Barbados, the apartment in New Jersey, and a home in Singapore. The real estate was unloaded in an orderly fashion and netted $6.3 million. They controlled 11 corporate bank accounts hidden around the world, with an aggregate balance of just over $5 million. Under court order and pressure from the State Department, a bank in Singapore opened a lockbox owned by the two. It was filled with diamonds, rubies, sapphires, rare coins, and 10-ounce gold bars. The appraisal was $11 million. The same pressure was applied to a bank in Barbados, and it produced the same type of loot. Its appraisal was $8.8 million. The four condos in Rabbit Run were sold for about $1 million each. Around the FBI offices in Tallahassee, the impressive loot acquired by the ladies was referred to as the Whistler Fund. Its assets were slowly sold off by the receiver, and a year after their arrests, the Whistler Fund had a balance of $38 million. On paper, the figure was astonishing, though as it slowly increased over the months, the shock wore off. Attorney Greg Myers filed a claim for a reward from the Whistler Fund. Court-appointed attorneys for McDover and Turbin filed the standard objections to the selling of the assets, with no luck at all. Once everything had been forfeited, and there was nothing but a pile of cash, the attorneys had no real argument. What could they say? The money was not stolen? So they retreated, then disappeared. Attorneys for the Tapakola argued the money belonged to the tribe, and the judge agreed. However, the money would never have been found, and the entire web of corruption exposed, if not for the courage of Joe Helen, Cooley, and Greg Myers. The Tapakola were not blameless. They had elected and re-elected a crooked chief. Of the $38 million, the judge awarded $10 million. Half to Joe Helen, and 25% each to Myers and Cooley. He also left no doubt they would be entitled to an even larger award one day in the distant future when all of the assets from the DuBose Syndicate were finally found and sold. On January 14, 2013, 15 months after they were arrested, the five cousins were put on trial in the federal courthouse in Pensacola. By then, they knew that Clyde Westbay and Zeke Foreman would testify against them. They knew that Clyde had pled guilty to first-degree murder the day he was arrested, and that he would serve a lesser sentence yet to be decided. They had no idea where Zeke Foreman was hiding, and didn't really care. Their party was over. They were concentrating on their grim futures. In a courtroom with a lot of spectators, Paula Galloway, A lawyer who still loved the arena presented the government's case. Her first witness was Verna Hatch. Lacey was the second. There were photos and videos of the accident scene. She was on the stand for an entire day and found the experience exhausting. She hung around, though, and sat through the entire trial with Verna. Many of Hugo's friends and family came and went during the 8-day trial. They watched the video of the Dodge Ram being stolen, and the one from Frog's store. Zeke Foreman was an excellent witness. Clyde Westbay nailed the convictions, though he was nervous and refused to look at any of the defendants. None of them testified. Their defense remained unified throughout. All for one, one for all. If they went down, they would all flame out together. The jury deliberated 6 hours and convicted all five. The following week, Paula Galloway pursued her quest for the death penalty, but came up short. The jurors had little trouble sentencing Von Dubose and Hank Scully to death. Von had ordered the hit. Hank had arranged the details. But it was never made clear if the Mayton brothers or Ron Skinner even knew about the plan. Under the law, a gang member is guilty for the crimes of his gang, whether involved in them or not. But the jury could not bring itself to sentence the other three to death. Instead, they were given life with no parole. With the cousins convicted and banished forever, Paula Galloway was more willing to cut deals with the other RICO defendants. Most agreed to plead to reduce charges and received, on average, 60 months in prison. One, a long-time trusted gopher named Willis Moran, wanted no part of prison. He had a brother who'd been raped and murdered in one, and he, Willis, was terrified of the possibility. During several interrogations, he hinted that he knew something about the murders of Sonras Coe and Eileen Mace, and even the disappearance of Digger Robles, the jailhouse snitch. The FBI had little interest in busting Moran with a long sentence, or a short one, for that matter, and a plea deal was negotiated in which he would serve only the time he'd already spent in jail. Over the years, Moran had at times worked with Delgado, who was Vaughn's favorite hitman. It was known, at least among the veterans, that Delgado was very accomplished at taking people out, and that he was the most likely killer of San and Eileen. Reluctantly, Ali Pacheco opened yet another chapter in the Dubose story. 2 months after the murder trial, Claudia McDover and Phyllis Turbin were brought into a courtroom in the federal building in Tallahassee, surrounded by their lawyers. Both had already pled guilty to bribery and money laundering. Now they would be sentenced. The judge addressed Phyllis first, and after a good scolding, sent her away for 10 years. His attack on Claudia was one for the archives. In a prepared text, he lashed out at her astonishing greed, her sickening dishonesty, her cowardly betrayal of the trust given to her by the voters. A stable society is built on notions of fairness and justice, and it's left to judges like you and me to make sure all citizens are protected from the corrupt, the violent, and the forces of evil. At times scathing, at times caustic and sarcastic, and never for a moment the least bit sympathetic, the judge's sentencing tirade raged for 30 minutes and startled many in the courtroom. Claudia, frail and much thinner after 17 months of jailhouse food, stood as straight as possible and absorbed the blows. Only once did she seem to waver, as if her knees were losing strength. Never did she shed a tear, nor did she take her eyes off the judge. He gave her 25 years. In the front row, Lacey, with Allie on one side and Jo Helen on the other, almost felt sorry for her. This is Cassandra Campbell. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Whistler by John Grisham. This program was directed by Tony Hutz, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2016 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.